Though I Came to the Maharshi by Francis Allen. This is the story of how Bhagavan, whom I never met, came, I believe, into my life during World War II. I was posted from England to Ceylon, where I became so interested in Theravada Buddhism that I determined to enter the Sangha. I was informed by monks there that they could not give me ordination without first obtaining my parents' consent. After being demobilized in England, I joined a small London group studying Theravada. Another member of which was a lady who, it transpired, had been to Tiruvannamalai. I discovered this one day when I heard her telling a mutual friend how she had gone to Sriramanashramam with a personal problem. For the first time in my life, I then heard the name of Sri Ramana Maharshi. Bhagavan, she explained, had merely smiled and indicated that she settled herself upon a mat in his hall. Whereupon, without words passing between them, the solution to her trouble had soon presented itself to her mind. This she informed her London friend was nothing unusual where Bhagavan was concerned. I made up my mind there and then to break my return journey to Ceylon at Tiruvannamalai. Unfortunately, although my father had agreed to my ordination as a Buddhist monk, my mother withheld her permission, fearing it was merely a passing impulse on my part. I had returned to a good job in London, and she was reluctant to see me disappear, perhaps forever, into a faraway monastic life. Months passed, until one evening, I returned home from a particularly trying day at the office, feeling tired and looking, I dare say, dejected. My mother greeted me with the words, "I can see you are as keen as ever to go back to Ceylon. You have my permission, if you think it will make you happy." That day was April 14th, 1950. Well, we didn't make it in time. That's the day for Samadhi Day. The very day that miles and miles away from London, Bhagavan left the body. It was not until I arrived in Bombay that I discovered this. And imagining that Bhagavan was no more, I went to Colombo. It was another few years before I met Ethel Merston, who suggested I should read Arthur Osborne's book, Ramana Maharshi, and the Path of Self-Knowledge. After that, with the assistance of Ronald Rose, I arrived at Ramanashram. Do you know Ronald Rose? He came to the New York Ashram, I remember, in the 70s.
Oh, yeah?
He had been to Ramanashram, really. I think he was a writer or something. What, I wonder, would Bhagavan have advised me if I had visited him en route to the Buddhist monastery? Had he warned me of what was going to come of it? I should have found it impossible to believe. At that time, I had set my heart on embracing the monastic life, and any dissuasion would not have deterred me, yet would have filled me with foreboding uneasiness. No, I imagined that, simply smiling, Bhagavan would have left me to go ahead and work out in my own way what was a particularly complicated part of my destiny. The end of the article.
That's What? What happened there?
Why was this published?
Yeah.
Well, it is interesting. Didn't you find it interesting?
It was finding it starting to be interesting.
Yes.
They give a picture here. Here's a quote from Sultan Abu Sa'id Ibn Khayr. He said, "He on whose destiny God has inscribed, my lover, rises above all ritual and laws of normal religion. The lover ignores worship in temple or mosque, being beside himself in God's intoxication." And there's a big article on the contemplative of life in the modern world by Father Thomas Merton.
Oh, my goodness.
I saw a correspondence between Thomas Merton and Arthur Osborne about this article. Father Thomas Merton is widely known as a Trappist monk who has become famous through his books as an exponent of a deeper truth of Christian teaching, the truth of the Spirit which bloweth where it listeth and is not necessarily confined to any one church or creed. The Abbey at Gethsemane, where he lives and where this article was written, is a community of contemplative monks, of a Cistercian order, Trappist. You know, the first Trappist monastery in North America was in Nova Scotia.
Oh.
Burned down. There's a town called Monastery in Nova Scotia on the way to Cape Breton.
Okay.
Probably past it. Maybe you've seen a sign.
I don't remember.
Yeah. And the monastery burned down and they rebuilt and it burned again and they left. They came to
message.
But then another monastery was built there, Benedictine.
That
stayed. Famous for the Trappist, famous for their dedication to silence, manual labor, solitude, meditation, and liturgical worship. The Abbey was founded in Kentucky, one of the southern states of the USA. That's after they left Nova Scotia, 1848.
So it was the same group.
By monks from France. The monks observed the rule of Saint Benedict in its strict interpretation and do not engage in teaching or in preaching. Though in some exceptional cases, they write books. There is one monastery of the same order in Japan, another near Hong Kong, yet another in Indonesia, as well as several nuns in Japan. Well, they have it right in Massachusetts also. I don't know. I don't know about that. Can contemplation still find a place in the world of technology and conflict, which is ours? It's 1965.
I didn't even know technology.
Right.
Little did they know. He's from Columbia University, graduated. Mm-hmm. He was a journalist here in New York City.
Oh, yeah?
You know, this Thomas Merton. Then he became a monk. Does it belong only to the past? The answer to this is that since the direct and pure experience of reality and its ultimate root is man's deepest need, contemplation must be possible if man is to remain human. If contemplation is no longer possible, then man's life has lost the spiritual orientation upon which everything else, order, peace, happiness, sanity, must depend. But true contemplation is an austere and exacting vocation. Those who seek it are few, and those who find it fewer still. Nevertheless, their presence witnesses to the fact that contemplation remains both necessary and possible. Now this is like a 3-page article. And then they have the same title with Joel Goldsmith, The Contemplative Way of Life. And he writes, "This is the last of the series of articles that Joel Goldsmith sent to the Mountain Path prior to his regretted demise in June 1964. It has been our pleasure as well as our privilege to publish them. A good deal of unpublished material still remains. We are told, with his editor and literary executor, Lorraine Sinclair, and it is possible that through her kindness, we may still be able to publish new Joel Goldsmith articles as he himself wished." This is also a very long article. Very longer. The Mother's Lament, translated by Professor K. Swaminathan from the Tamil of Muruganar. It's just a verse. "From all and sundry, oft my child had heard of the dear might of Ramana, much concerned. I warned her to have naught with him, but she, brushing aside my fears and fancies, sought to grasp and hold clear, firm within her heart his heavenly form. The world laughs now at her, for she has tasted maddening bread, glimpsed truth, the poison whose sole antidote is more, and more of it, till one has eaten all." And from the Mahanirvana Tantra, quote, "For one who knows that all is Brahman, there is nothing to meditate upon, and no one who meditates." You heard of this Agnathaswarn?
Yeah.
From the Blue Mountain something. Blue Mountain Retreat or Ashram in California.
The first Bhagavad Gita I read was a translation by him.
Yeah, he's a good writer. Yeah. Here's one by Arthur Osborne under the name of Sagittarius. "Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." From Matthew chapter 5, verse 48. One of the hidden pearls I alluded to in my article of April 1964, one of those sayings of Christ which modern Christians ignore, is his injunction to his followers to be perfect as God is perfect. But it is worse than that. They do not merely ignore it, but deny its possibility, thereby revealing a presumptuous disagreement with the master they claim to follow. There is no more fundamental injunction in the whole Bible than this, for it is the injunction to realize the supreme identity. For how can you be perfect without being one with the Father? Christ himself said that only God is good. St. Mark chapter 10, verse 18. Furthermore, he reminded his Jewish critics of the saying in their own scriptures, "I said, you are gods." He referred to men as sons of gods and bade them address God as Father. And St. Paul also told them that they were all sons of God in Christ. If then a man is the son of God, and can be called a God, and, as Christ also said, contained the kingdom of heaven within him, what is this but the supreme identity? This injunction marks Christianity as a complete religion, envisaging and striving after the supreme goal of identity or self-realization, referred to in Hinduism as moksha, in Buddhism as nirvana, in Sufism as panna. By denying its possibilities, Christ's purblind followers have degraded their religion, which they still honor with his name, to the lower level of one that envisages only the proximate goal of a purified individuality and a formal paradise. A high goal, no doubt, but not the highest, not the perfection Christ enjoined, not real goodness, for only God is good. So, resourceful is the human mind, however, that the blinkered theologians who have thus rejected Christ's command and restricted his religion have managed to turn the tables and make out the inferiority thus accepted to be superiority. They omit the truth of Christ saying, I and my Father are one, but limit it to him alone, so that if they have only one perfect man, other religions have none at all. This belief is on a painfully low level of intelligence. Divine laws are universal, even physically. This is obvious. So how much more spiritually? The true doctrine of identity is simple, and yet at the same time intellectually satisfying. Being is one. Therefore, you cannot be other because there is no other. Therefore, if you realize your true self, you realize your identity with the One, the Father, and are perfect, as He is perfect. Only the imperfections of your apparent individual nature make you appear other. Therefore, if you remove them and become perfect, as the One is perfect, you realize your pre-existent identity with the One. In place of this, they put a myth to be taken on faith, that some perfect but not infinite or universal being, how can he be infinite or universal if he excludes others, creates a lot of separate imperfect beings, and among them, one perfect one. Apart from that, he makes it a rule that none of them can become perfect, although this one who is tells them too. No wonder they have to ignore or reject Christ's sayings if they want to foist so crude a doctrine on people. This impossibility of obeying Christ's injunction to be perfect has become an article of faith with many who call themselves Christians. One of them once asked Swami Ramdas whether it is possible for a man to be perfect and without sin. And when the Swami cheerfully answered yes, he looked shocked, as though he had heard some blasphemy. Have none of the Christian saints and mystics attained the perfection of conscious identity? It is clear from the records they have left that some of them have, and had an intellectual understanding of it, fortified by at least occasional glimpses of realized identity. Eckhart certainly came near enough to be excommunicated. Quote, thou shalt lose thy thyness and dissolve in his hisness. They thine shall be his mind, so utterly one mind that thou in him shalt know in eternal wise his isness, free from becoming his nameless nothingness. Okay.
Sounds about right.
That's a convoluted way of saying it.
Yeah.
I guess he has to sort of hide it, what he's saying, because they're going to execute him for blasphemy. The Protestant mystic Jacob Bohm said, as I quoted in my article of October 1964, God has become that which I am and has made me that which he is. Well, that's pretty clear. The mystic Tauler, T-A-U-L-E-R, when through all manner of exercises, the outer man has been converted into the inward man, then the Godhead negatively descends into the depths of the pure soul, so that the spirit becomes one with him, unquote. The modern Christian mystic Joel Goldsmith reiterates it constantly throughout his books. Now is a time of crass materialism among the masses, both learned and ignorant, and of earnest seeking by the few. It is not too much to hope that some, at least, of Christ's followers will assume that he really meant what he said, and refuse to be hobbled and blinkered any longer by those who claim to speak in his name. And my sister, I used to give her the books like The Practice of the Presence of God, or, these old books, Imitation of Christ and things. I said, no, that's not modern. That's for those ages, that doesn't tell the truth of today's Christianity. Simplicity, a note by Ellen Chabot. It seems to me that people make sadhana dreadfully complicated. They seem to believe that the more complicated it is, the better. One reads so many unnecessarily complicated modern books and meets so many seekers who come to the ashram but seem to find the absolutely simple and straightforward teaching of the Maharshi about the one self too simple to be true. They find its very simplicity confusing. And a quote from Wei Wu Wei, Arthur Osborne's favorite. He puts articles on all over. Leave objects to look after themselves, if any, and recognize the absence of their subject as an object. The Silence of the Mind, this is by Robert Lenson. We published this article by one of the most eminent Western exponents of Zen, not because the mountain path is concerned with the views of modern psychology as to mental processes or accepts all its findings, but because the author's conclusion that thought must finally be stilled and that the ego, who is the thinker, resists this process so long as it can, owing to its instinct for self-preservation. With profound intuition and cogent reasoning, he uses psychology to undermine the conception of the psyche. In order to know ourselves, we must be able to answer the quadruple question: what do we think? Why do we think? How do we think? And finally, who thinks? I think you answer the last one.
Yes.
In the West, most of us claim to be positive and realistic. In fact, we are incoherent in our inner life. As long as we are unaware of the deep motives of our thoughts and of our desires and actions, we are incoherent and there is spiritual disorder. We are well aware, as a matter of fact, that most human beings today are unable to answer the questions why or how we think. Progress made in psychology has made it clear to us how inaccurately we answer even the simplest of all questions: what do we think? We know that the conscious part of ourselves, that which we know with relative clearness, is only a small part of our total self. Beyond this peripheric?
Spell it.
P-E-R-I-P-H?
Periphery.
Peripheric. Oh, that's on the peripheral.
Yeah.
Periphery, yeah.
and superficial consciousness, there lie a series of deep layers forming the unconsciousness. We can consider it a huge recording of the past, full of the scorings of all incomplete actions, incomplete thoughts, incomplete emotions. It is a fact that a complete act, a complete thought, leaves no score on the mind. As Lao Tzu said, he who walks the Tao leaves no trace. The then unconscious, quote-unquote, or Krishnamurtis, unknown, are on the contrary absolutely new to the mind. They are not a result. We can reach the Zen unconscious only by freeing ourselves of the contents of the collective unconsciousness. It is easy to understand that we can attain full realization of the present only by liberating our mind from the identification with the past. The answer to the question, how and why we think, can only be given after having solved this first question of what we think. It is far more complex and goes far beyond the field generally explored by psychologists or psychoanalysts. In my works, I have explained in all detail the operational process of an associative habit, which, from the atom to human thought, passing through molecules, cells, amoeba, and other stages, continually works by accumulation, leading to the supreme crystallization, both psychic and psychological, of the me, or ego. Thought is the manifestation of associative habit on the psychological level. We associate ourselves with objects, with our bank account, our name, our body, our political, physiological or philosophical and religious ideas with memories of our relationship with different things or on our psycho-physical environment. The feeling of our continuity and psychological solidity is a result of rapid and complex superimpositions of thoughts. All of them converge towards the same goal. The possibility of experiencing oneself as a distinct and continuous entity. It is in this direction that we must investigate if we wish to be able to answer the double question, what and how we think. Thought may be regarded as an invaluable aid to the ego's instinct for self-preservation. Okay. Okay, this is that one that Ramesh is always crazy about. Spontaneous awakening. I've been trying this for years. He keeps asking, where's that article? Readers of the Mountain Path already know Douglas Harding from his article, Self-Inquiry, Some Objections Answered, in our issue of April 1964. In the present article, he tells a story showing how the spirit bloweth where it listeth, independent of forms and tradition. This is the first article to be published about a very remarkable, yet outwardly very unremarkable young Englishwoman. In his brief description of how her life has, almost without warning and practically overnight, been altogether revolutionized, written by a friend who has throughout been her close companion and sole confidant. Its purpose is to encourage all serious spiritual seekers, and particularly those who imagine that true illumination is necessarily a long way off, or almost impossibly difficult, or the preserve of some particular sect or religion, or indeed the product of any religious discipline at all. The case of Helen Day Grupton shows that you never can tell. It brings home to us afresh, in our own time and circumstances, the tremendous reality of what Masefield calls the glory of the lighted soul, demonstrating in the most concrete and vivid way the joy and splendor that await us all just around the corner of our life. Press right upon us here and now as we read these words. We can't be too often reminded not only of the existence of our infinite treasure, but also of its perfect accessibility and naturalness, its homeliness and handiness, and immense practicality, and above all, its aliveness. To remain satisfied with anything less than this just doesn't make sense. It was about 4 years ago when I first met Helen. Since then, we've worked very closely together, all the while in the same organization, seeing a great deal of each other during the day, and increasingly when off duty. I should know her fairly well. Let me try to describe the first impression she made. If this sounds like an employer's testimonial, why, that's what it is after all, but with what a difference. I saw Helen as a lively, healthy-minded, and healthy-bodied, very intelligent, but not at all intellectual woman in her late 20s. In repose, her face was on the stolid side, with splendid eyes, but what brightness when she smiled. She proved quick to learn all the complex details of her job, practical and level-headed, conscientious, after her own independent fashion, humorous, tactful, and easy with people as a rule, and usually patient and self-controlled when things went wrong. In short, a treasure. No nonsense about Helen. Not even powder or lipstick. That I've detected anyway. Athletic, clear complexion, scrupulously turned out. What does that mean?
It's the way she looks, the way she makes herself up.
Good looking, in an unobtrusive way, not pretty. The ideal confidential secretary and a charming friend. But I still felt obliged in the end to take her into task. It seemed to me that she didn't know her own value. Her job, though a responsible one, could lead nowhere, and she was clearly capable of something much more creative. Her interests, tennis, swimming, fairly wide, but though desultory reading, which included a few religious books and certainly no mystical ones, listening to music of all kinds, some youth club work neglected in recent years, regular but unenthusiastic Church of England attendance, and the sort of superficial friendships such as a cheerful and popular young person would naturally make. These seemed not to reflect her true character and potentialities. I had the cheek to tell her so, rather often. She offered no comment, but she did eventually make serious plans to train as a probation officer, and a wonderful one she would have made. You know, he's her boss, so he can tell her anything he wants. He doesn't say anything. Wants to keep the job. We were fond of each other without seeming to make any deep contact. Inevitably, she got to know about my concern with spiritual matters, but no pressure at all was exerted. I had no desire to steer her in that way or any other direction. And certainly she seemed the most unlikely subject, altogether too normal and down to earth, not a spiritual type at all. In a certain sense, I still think she isn't, thank God. Besides, and how unlike so many of us, how spiritually unfashionable, almost reprehensible. Helen solemnly assured me that she loved and been loved by her admirable parents, led a happy childhood, enjoyed her grammar school, she must have been a fine head, perfect, and found her office work pleasant enough. Her most testing experience was the loss of her fiancé, and in fact death, or some other insuperable obstacle, has intervened to break no fewer than 3 engagements. The significance of this seeming tragedy isn't lost on her, of course. And she is now...
On her, sorry.
What?
Is of what on her?
It's not lost.
Not lost
it's
on
not
her.
Not lost, okay.
And more than happy to remain single and quite unattached to any man. No, Helen is altogether too well balanced a young woman, lacking almost all the current credentials, no tangled complexes, no awful history or suffering, no prolonged and bitter struggle to be what in fact she is, a most gifted mystic. I suspect really that the best masters of the spiritual life were, like Ramana Maharshi, specially sane and healthy, the reverse of abnormal. Yet when she typed for me some article about mystical religion, she scarcely seemed interested and had less than usual to say. It's true that when she came to our house for an evening or to stay for a day or two, she got into the habit of picking up one of my books on Vedanta or Sufism or Zen and reading it. And I noticed that she always finished what she started, however difficult or dull the author. She also read my own little book on having no head, but made nothing of it, I now learn. At the time, she was too polite to say so. She wants to keep her job. This brings me to the real beginning of the story. In May 1964, in what we sometimes call the 10 days that shook the world, that's her his own thing, I guess. Helen was off to Eastbourne for the Whitsun holidays. Whitsun is a British thing.
British, yeah.
W-H-I-T-S-U-N. And anxious to take some of my books with her. I remember these included Aldous Huxley's Perennial Philosophy. Evidently, she had become really interested. Something was happening. I knew Helen came back, deeply stirred and now eager to talk. Douglas, she said. And I think I can quote almost the exact words. After all, it was only a few months ago. I just realized something. All this applies to me. And of course, absolutely nothing else matters. She explained how the whole thing had, after a few weeks of inward search, accompanied by increasing concern and tension, became perfectly clear to her. Now it made sense. She'd taken it to heart, and this was quite overwhelming. Those evenings that followed, when she walked alone for hours in the park, wearing dark glasses, so that people shouldn't see that she was crying for joy at the wonder of her discovery, the transformed world, the colors that positively sang, the exquisite beauty of everything, yes, everything including the rubbish in those wire baskets, or the garbage for the park. Morning after morning in the office, I was to hear from Helen this kind of story. Often, indeed, usually, it was. No sleep at all last night, Douglas. Time just flashed by. Again, it was just joy. Oneness, clarity. From time to time, I laid down to when I got up for breakfast, fresher than I had slept the whole night. The extraordinary thing is, I never feel tired. I remember her explaining how she felt home, how she left home, and presently found herself at the office half a mile away. And the interval was just brightness, no thinking, with no recollection of having walked at all. I remember also her trying to explain how, on other occasions, her walking was just like taking the dog for a walk. Her legs and their movement had been like a dog's, nothing to do with her. It was a wonderfully free and easy feeling, yes indeed. Many other surprises were in store for us. Helen's tennis always goodish.
Goodish?
Goodish.
Yeah. How does it spell?
Yeah.
Oh, good, good, goodish.
Good, yeah. Okay, then.
Yeah, okay.
Immediately became quite remarkably good. So goodish means bad?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Good.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, not so good.
Less than remarkably good.
Yes.
I would think it sounds goodish. That means good is like.
So you're being polite.
Going toward good.
To the astonishment of the members of her club, and their greater astonishment and disappointment when she announced that she wasn't going to play anymore after completing the game that had already been fixed for her. Those games she won brilliantly, automatically. To me, her explanation was that she did nothing. Her racket did it all. The game played itself with the skill and ease she'd never known. Part of the secret, we agreed, must have been that whereas before she had always wanted very much to win, now she had no feelings at all, one way or the other. And the resulting relaxation naturally helped her performance. But she insisted that she didn't do anything. Again, she was the onlooker. And lest anyone should suppose she'd been reading Herigel's book on Zen archery, I happen to know she still hasn't done so. All ambition, all other interests had gone. The probation officer project was dropped at once. In fact, Helen even discussed with me the possibility of getting a routine job, such as a copy typist, which would interfere as little as possible with her new life. This idea, however, was soon scrapped because she found that her work, however complicated, practically did itself as she didn't interfere. More remarkably, it did itself, I noticed, even more accurately and rapidly than before. It had to. We spent so much time in the office on other business, on our real business. Just let things happen, she said, and they turn out perfect. Do them deliberately, plan ahead, and they go wrong. Before she'd generally been rather pressed for time, now she had all the time in the world. I'm sure everyone in the office noticed the change in her. One man who, somewhat unreasonably, I thought, she hadn't much liked, was now quite nice, really. And it was all Helen's fault. It was plain how happy she was. People asked what had come over her, and she looked like a cat that had just had kittens, someone remarked. Not that she was changed beyond recognition. Thank goodness the old, charmingly informal Helen, with most of her personal quirks, was still with us. There was nothing odd or unnatural or spectacular about the change in her. If anything, she was more truly normal and natural than ever. So much so that some who don't know Helen very well, but have preconceived notions of the outward effects of illumination, naturally doubt whether anything more than a psychological reorganization akin to those religious conversions, which are common enough, has occurred in her. And, of course, one cannot find in Helen, or in any other, what one hasn't begun to find in oneself. Her ego had never stuck out very far. Now it was imperceptible, except perhaps for occasional irritation with some particularly difficult client or employer. No, it comes back occasionally, she confessed to me. But now I see clearly when it's there. Lately, I think even this rare and trivial ego system has disappeared. Though she remains capable, we just discovered, of momentary anger. Obviously, she no longer had moods, but was permanently happy whatever happened. And she had no need to tell me about her changed feeling for people. Her heart really went out to them. She enjoyed and loved them, not equally, it's true, but far more than she'd ever done before. How many times she walked into my office exclaiming, "What a wonderful person so-and-so is, Douglas." And her glowing face and shining eyes were eloquent of her feeling. As at the time, she no longer saw us through the distorting spectacles of self-interest, but as we really were. And in some instances, this shocked her. Unsuspected weaknesses and meannesses were now quite plain. Hidden motives showed themselves. She was no longer deceived. And Helen had no time for the old social round, no time for idle chatter or hobbies or amusements, no time at all except for the one thing that mattered, and all her time for that alone. She somehow got out of those always rather pointless little lunch parties, all reading, including newspapers, except for books on the subject. Her tennis, of course, and even her swimming is in the end. It was the swimming that warned us that her tremendous spirit might be asking too much of her body. One evening in late July, I drove Helen to her beach hut, and as we parted, something made me beg her to be very careful. She wasn't. Next morning at the office, she told me how rough the sea had been and how she'd got out beyond the breakers only to become mixed up with a large stinging jellyfish. And then, to cap it all, realized the strength of the current pulling away from the shore. She remained perfectly calm and content. And these are roughly her own words. And just waited to see what would happen. Without any effort on her part, her body somehow took her shorewards, where a large wave just picked her up and deposited her quite gently on the beach. There she was, surprised to find herself trembling and exhausted. Helen had become much too careless of her health. She walked and walked goodness knows how far. Though always with that unhurried, loose-limbed, easy gait of hers, which is almost like the lope of some animal, she ate too little and irregularly, and rapidly lost weight, night followed night, without sleep. Her newfound happiness was so great. When, however, she did at last sleep, it was, from then right up to now, always dreamlessly. Thus, this surprised her because she had been used to dreaming a lot. It interested me, too, because unlike her, I knew that one of the marks of the illumined is that they dream little or not at all. After a few weeks of living like this, no wonder she went down with an attack of her old complaint of anemia and had to take it easy, physically. Spiritually, things continued to get better and better, though she couldn't understand how that was possible. If she then read and talked much less, this wasn't because she was tired, but so spiritually fresh that talking and reading books about it had become rather pointless. She was their author. She was it. The weeks following Helen's return from Eastbourne had been a time of ecstasy. Let me quote her own words, typical of that period, hastily scribbled on a scrap of paper without regard for grammar or punctuation, and only just rescued from destruction by me. Quote, light dazzling, pure light, clear brilliance, a feeling of being carried away weightlessly. 11 to 5:30, time of non-existent, endless eternity. No physical tiredness, sleep out of question, feeling of acceleration and peace. Happening for the first time like fog or a curtain drop completely away. This is all that matters for always. There must be a heaven on earth. Why explain? Words are useless and unnecessary, but the knowing constant. So 26 May 1964. I suggest at the time that this phase of Helen's illumination, we call it the gorgeous technicolor phase, would develop into an even profounder, more natural, okay, and virtually permanent state. And this soon happened, in fact. It is possible for me, is it possible for me to describe that state? To be continued.
Where was
England, that? England.
Okay, she looks beautiful in that photo.
29.